Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of July. It's All Things Political, which you always hear on Mondays at 9 o'clock. Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of many books on America in the 20th century and beyond, on various presidents, and his most recent book is Governing America. We have a lot to talk about. The campaign is now in full force. I'd like to start with the ads that started running over the weekend. Professor Zelizer has said that Obama and Romney will need to be careful that the spots they broadcast or which independent groups broadcast for them don't backfire on them rather than their opponents. They'll need to make sure to convey enough positive messages along with the negative, but it appears to be negative here in a big way. We'll talk about that new ad. We will be looking at a number of other issues, Tim Geithner and the banks. We will talk about health care reform, inequality, which is a challenge that Professor Zelizer says is integral to Obama's campaign and if he is reelected to his second term as president. And he makes some historical comparisons, namely FDR and Lyndon Johnson. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and you can reach us on Facebook. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Zelizer, hello. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So how about that new ad? It's been receiving a whole lot of attention. Romney singing America the Beautiful, quite a bit off key, but the message is about outsourcing and offshore accounts. Is it too negative, or is it a really good ad?
Well, it depends how much they focus on it. I mean, right now it's getting some traction. It's clearly put Mitt Romney on the defensive, and it's brought up an issue about economics that doesn't play in Mitt Romney's favor. It's a way to throw the economy back on Mitt Romney's back rather than having it on Obama. But there's clearly risks involved in this line of attack, from, you know, misinformation to the president's own record on job outsourcing to Republicans turning this into President Obama attacking free markets. That's what Romney did to Newt Gingrich very effectively, and I could see him doing that again.
What is the president's record on job outsourcing?
It's mediocre. I think it's not the president's fault that we've had this trend in outsourcing and exported jobs, but he hasn't really reversed it. And on trade issues, he's often been criticized for the left for doing much less than he had promised in his campaign in 2008. So he doesn't have a shining, stellar record on this. And so I think there's some risks there.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be, from what I've been reading, resonating some with the American public, this particular ad and that particular message, that he is out of touch, he's too wealthy, he's out of touch, and isn't really creating jobs.
Yes, it's a very good message, and it's always been the weakness of Mitt Romney. I mean, from the start, the campaign aimed to do this. They wanted to turn his strength, meaning Mitt Romney's record with business and capital, and turn it into his weaknesses, which is what all good campaigns try to do. And it's having some traction in independent states, though. You know, the president's going all out, and the polls are not dramatically moving at this point. So We have to kind of be cautious in evaluating how effective these are.
Let's talk a little bit about Bain, and let's start by listening to Mitt Romney. He had to answer how long he was managing member and whether or not he was telling the truth about that, or if he did give up any association when he became head of the Olympics. This is Mitt Romney speaking with CNN's Jim Acosta on Friday, and we'll ask your response to it.
Well, I was the owner of an entity that is filing that information, but I had no role whatsoever in the management of Bain Capital after February of 1999. Not that that would have been a problem to have said that I was with the firm beyond that, but I simply wasn't. I left in February of 1999 to go out and run the Olympics. I went out and did that full time, relinquished all management authority and role in Bain Capital after February of 1999.
Does that put the matter to rest?
No, it won't. I think these kinds of issues, when there's some degree of confusion, can live on for a long time. I mean, I do think the Romney campaign has been quite aggressive in trying to quash this and argue that there's nothing unusual about this, and they've, you know, had stories and business experts saying this could happen. But I don't think the issue is totally gone. I don't think this, in the end, is the kind of winning issue Romney should, that President Obama should focus on. I think the outsourcing is really the issue here, and that's the kind of question that they can get Mitt Romney on much more than this kind of, you know, quasi-scandal, which is good in the short term, but in the long term doesn't win elections.
Mm-hmm. So stop the focus on Bain. Do we need to know more about Bain?
Well, you can use Bain as a way to understand how Romney thinks about business and how he thinks about the economy, because that's the question. We've heard a lot from Republicans about what Obama does wrong and what the Democrats have done wrong, but we haven't heard much beyond tax cuts and some promises of deregulation what Mitt Romney's going to do. So this becomes a vehicle for Democrats to talk about what Mitt Romney's vision is for economic revitalization. And the way it works for Democrats is to say he doesn't really care if the jobs are here. He doesn't really have a feel for questions like unemployment. He's just interested in wealth and the wealthy. So that's the storyline they're trying to push, and that's where Bain becomes very useful as a window into who Mitt Romney is.
You have written recently about inequality, and you say it's a challenge that is integral to Obama's campaign and if he is reelected to his second term as president.
It's one of the big questions of the last decade or two decades, the rising inequality in the United States, the, you know, widening gap between the wealthy and the poor, the thinning of America's middle class. That's underlying a lot of the anxiety you see in the electorate. It's not just about a recession going on right now. It's about a much bigger trend that's going on where the middle class is not what it was in the 1950s and 60s. And I think this is an issue Democrats should address, need to address, and have political incentives to address. It's the kind of bread-and-butter issue Democrats in the year of FDR and Johnson have often done very well with, and Republicans have had more trouble. But thus far, the president's been a little hesitant to really tackle this in his first term.
And let's, because you're a history professor and have written about a lot of presidents, let's talk about how FDR handled this issue and how he didn't run away from the issue. He, of course, must have received widespread opposition to his ideas.
Oh, all the time. You know, he was attacked by business leaders and the wealthy, particularly as he started his re-election campaign in 1936 for dividing America, for playing into class resentment, for favoring one group of Americans over the other. All the kinds of rhetoric you hear today were, you know, common back then, and sometimes even worse, obviously tying him to what was going on in Europe, whether it was in Germany or elsewhere. And FDR was just very forthright in responding. Sometimes he could be very aggressive, and in 1936 he said that he welcomed the hatred of wealthier Americans who were attacking him. And in terms of public policy, he was just very straightforward. His programs aimed to provide economic security to middle-class Americans, whether it was the right to unionize through the Wagner Act or whether it was Social Security. And he didn't really shy away from that fight. And in many ways, I think it was central to why he was successful.
And Lyndon Johnson, more timid, but he certainly spoke up, and nobody has spoken up since Lyndon Johnson for the poor.
Johnson was very timid in taking on the wealthy. He was always very reluctant to have his opponents paint him as some left of center Democrat. That said, on the people he wanted to help, he was not shy. He said America was wealthy enough to take care of the poor and to give them the tools to be self-sufficient, and he launched a war on poverty. Lyndon Johnson said by 64 and 65, civil rights and voting rights was essential, and it wasn't a question that we could have a discussion about anymore, and he put himself on the side of the civil rights movement. So from poverty to civil rights to other issues like health care for the aged, he was very assertive about what he wanted to do and why he was going to do it. I think in general, President Obama has been much more defensive and really reluctant to take that kind of stand, even when he was promoting something like his health care bill.
And why do you think that's the case? Is it because he's new on the job and he had to figure out how everything works, or is it a lack of real feeling for this issue?
Part of it's the leader, so part of it is the strength and confidence that LBJ had allowed him to take these issues on in that way. Similarly with FDR, his charisma and sense of politics was very strong. Part of it is the times, you know. Obama is governing after Reagan was president, after we entered in this era of conservatism, where many issues that were once considered acceptable in political debate no longer are. So he governs in a very different time, is still in a conservative era. So I think it's both the leader and the context.
Romney, of course, is talking a lot about how the economy hasn't done very much under the current administration. Here's Charlie Rose and President Obama, an interview that aired over the past couple of days on CBS.
He clearly will say, let's look at your record. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the fact that unemployment is at 8.2%. It is unlikely to change. Mm-hmm. Let's look at how effective the stimulus was.
Right.
Let's look at your management of the economy.
Exactly.
Yes, it was a bad hand you were dealt,
right.
But you have not made it to what it ought to be.
Right.
That is the centrality of their campaign.
Exactly. That is his argument, and you don't hear me complaining about him making that argument, because if I was in his shoes, I'd be making the same argument.
Well, that doesn't do his cause much good, does it?
No, that's Obama the lawyer speaking, where he kind of lays out both sides of the argument. You know, that is the most powerful argument of the Republican campaign, and it's one that I think everyone in the White House realizes, including the president, can easily lose him this election. It's the state of the economy, and it's whether he's done enough for it. And I think every time Republicans move away from this theme, or every time the administration and the president are able to push media attention to other issues, such as when Romney left Bain, that's the way the Democrats do well. But if he can come back to the jobs numbers, if he could come back to whether the stimulus was effective or not, I think that's where Republicans feel most comfortable. I think that's where Romney himself is most alive on the campaign trail.
What do you think, Professor Zelizer, the president needs to do to get people back to work?
Well, I don't think there's anything he's going to be able to do right now. I mean, clearly there is room for a stimulus bill. Clearly, he's going to have to find a way to make sure that the middle class tax hikes don't end in the next few years. But then there's going to need to be some bigger policy initiative. If we accept that government should be part of the solution, and not everyone accepts that, you need more than a short-term stimulus, and you need more than continuing tax cuts. You need to think about how can government invest effectively into growing areas of the economy, just as they did with the computer industry in the 1950s and 60s, and just as the government's played a role in many areas that ultimately became the center of our economy, to give it a kickstart, to kickstart research, to really get things moving so we could compete with countries like China. If government's going to play a role, that's what it has to do if you want to think big rather than just short-term Band-Aid problems.
I haven't had one more question for me, and then we'll go to phone calls. The number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political, 800-486-8655. Send an email if you'd like at talk@WPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page at The Kathleen Dunn Show. Healthcare reform, we haven't spoken since the Supreme Court decision. Your response to this, you've written recently about this, that we really need to fix this, that I'm wondering just politically, does it make sense for the Republicans to drop this now, repeal of Obamacare, as they call it? And what does the president need to do to make this not only a winning issue in the campaign, but a winning issue for the American public in the years ahead?
I think for the Republicans, in terms of the election, to continue voting on repeal doesn't really do much. The polls are showing that a lot of voters, including these independents who are so treasured for November, want the Republicans to move on. And the Supreme Court, whatever you thought about the decision, did give some kind of legitimacy right now to the law. And so I think Republicans are simply, shooting themselves in the foot by continuing to talk about that rather than their central theme of the economy. And it's obviously a complex issue for Mitt Romney, who was the source of the program that became a model for President Obama. So kind of moving on, I think, is the smartest political move. In terms of what happens in the next 4 years, there's certainly a lot of room for Republicans to either dismantle the program altogether or to render it ineffective through budget cuts, through fighting the implementation on the state level. This is a program that is very complex, and it's jerry-built in many ways, so there's a lot of places to cause problems. And if Republicans don't want the law, I think that's where they should put their energy, rather than on just a total repeal or continuing to make it a campaign theme. For President Obama, it's simple. Get these benefits going as quickly as possible and make sure Americans understand the benefits are a result of the reform, so the coverage of people under 26, the health care exchanges, if they're working. The administration needs to explain and show that they're great and what they can do. If not, the program will be unpopular. So I think for the administration, it's kind of clear what they have to do. I think for Republicans, it's going to be trickier, and in some ways, the most effective attacks will be the most subtle. It will be slowly undermining the program once the operation starts.
I am a little confused about how the federal government is going to handle, because we do, as you well know, have a lot of red state governors who are saying that they're not going to do anything about this. They're hopeful that Romney will be elected, but that they're also not going to be looking at this expansion of Medicaid. And I'm wondering, will the Obama administration step in immediately to set up their own programs? What's going to be the political dynamic here? And what's the dynamic in terms of an expansion of Medicaid, a major part of the program?
Well, it's very unclear. I mean, you have the two issues. One is this expansion of Medicaid, which the states can now opt out of, which was really important to allowing this health care program work. There, I think the best option is for the administration to create strong incentives because within the states, a lot of these Republican governors are going to have a lot of opposition, not just from Democrats, but from the hospital industry and the medical industry, which needs that Medicaid money. So if the administration keeps kind of throwing things in front of those interests and making clear how much money is at stake, those Republican governors could easily buckle. The health care exchanges, I think, are more complicated. Theoretically, the federal government can step in and create a health care exchange if the state is not doing so. But it's not clear what that even means and how that will play politically if the government kind of takes over and does this on their own, and whether the government's going to have the stomach to do that, whether the administration will have the stomach to do that. So there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of that very question. How far will the federal government go to make sure this works, including on Medicaid, when the Supreme Court's made it doubly difficult right now?
Phone calls coming up momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. Or send an email if you'd like at talk@WPR.org. Professor Julian Zelizer is our wonderful guest. He is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of a number of books. His most recent is Governing America. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, the availability and quality of our water will continue to be a major issue for Wisconsin and the country. Water levels are 20 inches below the long-term average for the month of July. The drought conditions have created water availability problems for people in southern Wisconsin counties. We will be talking about this the second hour of our program. WPR reporter Chuck Wernbach will be with us to discuss Waukesha County's efforts to access Lake Michigan water. And then we'll have a conversation with the new director of UWM's Center for Water Policy. It is All Things Political now with Professor Julian Zelizer. Our number is 800-486-8655. Nate in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. I think the Republicans should continue to keep the health care, Obamacare, or whatever you wish to call it, an issue, because it does impact the economy and employers. I know of an employer who has about 200 employees, and he's trying to think of how he's going to be able to do his job with fewer employees if Obamacare is enacted.
Professor Zelizer.
That is an argument that Republicans are trying to make, especially about the uncertainty of how this will all work and what it's doing to business, as well as certain provisions. But I think the Republicans, some are making that argument, but the bigger theme they focused on still is repeal, and often connected to that economic argument. I still think that's two steps away from the big issue. And the big issue is jobs, joblessness, and to connect the dots to health care, to the economy, I think is a difficult move, and I think it can be counteracted by many Democratic spinners who show that that's not really what's going on, and it's not causing as many problems as people are arguing. So it's not that that argument isn't out there. It's about clarity, and in campaigns, clarity is everything, and I'm just not sure that's where Republicans are gaining traction.
An email from Simon who asks, why can't President Obama get the IRS to produce the tax return records to prove that Romney was still profiting from Bain overseas investments after 1999? And, of course, there's a call for him to release his tax returns.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, at this point, the question is whether Romney releases them. I don't think President Obama getting the IRS to release information would be the best political move for him. And certainly the optics of that attempt would not be what he wants. That's more of a kind of Nixonian move, and President Obama's not looking for that. So I think there's a lot of pressure on Romney to do this from Republicans as much as Democrats. And I think the more you hide things or the more you refuse to cooperate in things like this, the worse the issue becomes. And I wouldn't be surprised if Romney does this soon, because there's just a lot of Republicans calling for this on the front pages of newspapers.
Why wouldn't he just do it as a matter of course?
I don't know the answer, and I think that's what people are wondering. Whether it can't make him look wealthy, because people know he's wealthy and they know his background. So it's unclear why he's doing this. There might be something he thinks will look bad politically, and that's obviously a concern. Or it might be that just on certain issues you just want to stonewall and give the least information possible as a political strategy. But I don't think that works very well. So I think that's another area in which he's causing more of a story than he would need to. Again, unless there's something he really thinks would reflect poorly on him in the campaign.
Hugh in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. You're talking about Bain a lot and the outsourcing of jobs. But look at Obama, what he did a little over a month ago, when he basically gave an amnesty to up to 800,000 illegal aliens. Most of these are going to be Hispanic, and therefore, in applying for jobs and universities and so forth, they will have an affirmative action advantage over American citizens. This is outsourcing to illegals, and it's up to 800,000 people. This is the kind of madness of the Obama administration. And you want to talk about taxes and releasing information on that? What about all the writings of our president? You're a university professor. How could you get a new job, without showing your writings? Why hasn't anybody demanded that we expose the writings of both him and his wife? And I'm sure we'll find socialist and communist views expressed in those writings.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, I think on the immigration question, and President Obama knew the kind of political response he'd receive from that. That is an issue that will come up in the next few months. It's been out there. Obama's been very mixed on immigration. He actually has not been as liberal as many hope for, including many Republicans who are very liberal on immigration. But that stand with the amnesty will clearly excite some people. It will excite some on the right, and I'm sure it will be an issue going into the campaign. And Mitt Romney's been trying to toe a hard line on the immigration question. Again, the economics is very different than the outsourcing debate. And then on the other issues like taxes, that's going to be the central question for a lot of Republicans, and it's what they're trying to focus attention on.
And this call, we got to release their writings because they're socialists and communists, is a bit out there.
Yes, I mean, President Obama, there's a lot of, if you want writing and his history, it's all out there. There's not it's not as exciting as I think some hope, and much of it is available. But you know, the argument that President Obama is a socialist, is far left of center, has been something we've heard in Republican circles since Joe the Plumber in 2008. It's often been very effective, and what's remarkable is that from a Democratic perspective, Obama is a very centrist Democrat. Many on the left, not socialists, just left-wing Democrats, have been really frustrated with him because, again and again, he's shown that he is much more a Bill Clinton-era Democrat than even a Lyndon Johnson-era Democrat. So he's many steps removed from a socialist. Yet that is an argument that I think in some conservative circles has stuck.
Ed in West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
As I've been pointing out on these programs repeatedly, we have lost 400,000 private sector unionized jobs in the state of Wisconsin since 1946. The vast majority of them lost in Republican administrations, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and the NAFTA administration of Bill Clinton. Mr. Obama had nothing to do with this. It's unfortunate that he used some rhetoric with Charlie Rose this weekend on the interview. The other problem that Mr. Obama has in this state is that during the entire Act 10 debacle, when Mr. Walker basically stripped public employees of their collective bargaining rights, Mr. Obama was nowhere to be seen. He was 17 minutes from the state line just 4 days before the recall campaign ended, and he failed to come into Wisconsin. This is going to be a huge problem for him here in this state as he approaches November.
Oh, do you think it will be, Professor Zelizer?
I think it can be. I actually, my CNN column coming out tomorrow is on this and the strains with labor and the Democratic Party and President Obama in particular. On the outsourcing, as we said earlier, this is a dangerous line for the administration because, you know, outsourcing has been a central concern for a while, and it's certainly gone on, meaning the export of jobs, it's certainly gone on during his administration. Many in labor circles have argued that Obama's been good, but he hasn't really been great. And some complain he really hasn't done anything. So this could easily be turned against him, and it could trigger or aggravate some tensions that we've seen with the union movement. And in Wisconsin, they played out pretty dramatically. It was not about outsourcing, but it was about a crackdown on public unions. And President Obama's criticized. He just tweeted at the end his support for Walker's opponent, and he really was not part of this debate, and that was a conscious decision. I think the administration, like on some other issues, has been a little leery about identifying with core Democratic interests and issues and trying to position themselves in the center. When you get into these economic questions, President Obama's record is not as clean as some Democrats would hope for, and I think he's very vulnerable, not just on the overall jobs picture, but on some of these particulars about what he's actually done to stem some of the systemic problems this country faces with jobs.
Thanks, Ed. Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Your guest has just made a point somewhat similar to what Gary Young did in The Guardian today, which is that Obama is not particularly credible as a critique of the policies of Bain Capital, whether or not you agree with the critique. But I would like to ask another question. To what degree does Obama or the this administration have a chance to get back to reform on Wall Street because of the LIBOR scandal and what's been happening at J.D. Morgan? Because when Wall Street expected to be taken to the woodshed, he bailed them out, and they don't seem grateful. So is there a possibility that the reform on Wall Street may come back before the election? And if not, what do we face with a second Obama administration? So thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
It might. I mean, the real moment for financial reform was in 2009. It was at the height of not just a series of scandals or poor behavior that was revealed, but it was a true financial meltdown. The LIBOR scandal is taking place when the stock market is still doing relatively well, and there's clearly not a sense of crisis about this in the country right now. And it's very difficult to generate political support or the kind of political support you need for these kinds of reforms, given the power of Wall Street in counteracting them. So in some ways, the instant response, which seems to be that if he couldn't do it in 2009, given where we are right now, it's unclear this scandal or J.P. Morgan will be enough to really get true financial reform on the table. That will be one of the critical choices we look back on, not just the stimulus, but did Obama do enough on financial reform? There are many who think that was his missed opportunity. Back then, America was angry. There was a lot of bipartisan support for reforming Wall Street and really enacting tough financial regulations. That's not the path the administration pursued, and the regulations are proving to be quite weak. That said, I'm not sure we're at one of those unique moments when the power of the people can overcome the power of the interests on this kind of question.
Professor Zelizer, let's talk about all of this weird and very destructive weather for a moment. We're in a drought here. It's going to be 100 again today and again tomorrow. Most of the country has been suffering from excessive heat. A lot of the country from drought. Europe is having excessive rain. We've had fires. And we have scientists issuing a report yet again last week that it's being caused by what we're doing to the environment. I hear so little political discussion, and yet a lot of people are talking about this and saying, are we too late? Are we past a tipping point? What can we do about this? We're a little worried. Why don't we hear a lot of political response to what's going on in our daily lives that's very dramatic?
Well, this is where the power of the presidency and the power of the congressional leadership is very important, meaning part of what they do is not simply propose this policy or that policy. Part of what they do is they put certain issues on the agenda. They make them part of our national discussion. So environmental groups have been talking about this, and critics of environmental groups have been talking about this. But those sources are usually followed by the followers. It's not a national conversation. And I think these kind of climate change issues and whether they're related to the weather patterns we're seeing right now have been drowned out by other kinds of political questions that the leadership and the president are talking about, such as the economy. The environment has just taken, it's been a sideshow in the last few years. And so what's the connection between the weather we're seeing and bigger public policy questions? It is just something no one's talking about. And so if leaders don't talk about it, the media then doesn't cover it or talk about it, and it loses its salience is a policy issue or a political issue, and it's really just a weather issue. So the Weather Channel covers it rather than the news channels. And, that's again, it's a choice in part about where leaders think they should put their bets for the election.
Mm. And what do you think? Do you think we should be paying attention? I'm just curious.
I think we should. I mean, I think there's overwhelming evidence from scientists, respected scientists, that we have big problems with the climate. And at least some of what we're seeing with the weather is related to that, and there's big risks if we don't take action. So this is not an issue that has as much short-term interest to people, so it's a real long-term question. It's about really systemic changes we need to make, so it's hard to get it into the ears and make it a focal point for politicians, but I think it's something that needs to be dealt with now, not in 10 years. That's the whole point of the problem.
Peter in Stoughton, hi.
Good morning. We can talk about the weather, and we can talk about Wall Street, and we can talk about health care reform, and we can talk about jobs and this and that. How come nobody is talking about our wars? They're costing us hundreds of millions of dollars each day. The consequences are going to last for at least a century, but nobody's talking about it. We're all tied up with all this other piddly stuff, and we're spending a huge amount of everything on in places that are meaningless and have no future to the United States. Where's the talk about that?
Look, foreign policy's taken a back seat. That happens in a lot of elections. simply in terms of the question of what are we doing with our foreign policy? Are we taking the right steps either in wars we're engaged in or in other diplomatic initiatives in areas like the Middle East? You know, these are missed opportunities because it's only in elections that you get real national interest in this and you get national discussions. But it's being swamped by the economy right now. Just compare it to 2008 when foreign policy was front and center. Part of it is within the Democratic Party. I mean, a lot of the critics of these wars were not Republicans, they were Democrats. And once President Obama was the leader rather than President Bush, there was a noticeable quiet about what we were doing in foreign policy and less of a discussion and less criticism. And that happens sometimes when the opposition takes over. And Republicans have not been opposed to Afghanistan in general, although they've been critical now of how it's being done. So that just died out. And finally, you know, we are withdrawing from both wars. So that takes some of the kind of political impetus and strength away from the issue.
Rosen Stratford writes, the Republican Congress has, as Mitch McConnell promised, done nothing but try to block all legislation, including recovery and jobs bills, for over 3 years. How they can blame this administration for present economic conditions since they've been blocking all possible legislation in their attempts to ruin this administration, regardless of how it hurts the middle class?
Well, she's right, but the answer is they can do it easily. And that's what congressional opponents do. They have enormous power, and they have the ability through procedure, through the budget, to block initiatives, to make progress impossible on certain issues. But the public doesn't see that. Congressional procedure is arcane. It's difficult to follow. And what people focus on is the president accomplishing his goals or her goals or not. And so, you know, that's exactly what the congressional opponents do to a president, both parties. And, you know, what's hard is the president wants to make it an issue. He wants to talk about the do-nothing Congress. It's often ineffective because, you know, people don't follow the minutia of filibuster reform. They don't often like a president who complains. They like a president who explains. And the president's aware that that's a risk. And finally, Democrats control the Senate. And so he can't do what President Truman did in 1948 in his attacks on a do-nothing Congress when the Republicans were in control, because now he has to attack his own party as well. And a lot of Democrats get angry with that because they're running for re-election and they're feeling vulnerable because of him. So it's a really complex strategy, and it's a very difficult task to make that issue something that really works in this particular election.
David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. I'm glad some of the discussion has turned to what may actually lead to alternative currencies. Ralph Nader's been pushing that for years, and when the obvious corruption gets so paramount that you can't believe the money anymore, a lot of local currencies could be created to subvert their paradigm. You know, what I wanted to ask your guest, though, is there was some discussion about Mitt Romney's tax legal papers being released. And it's been discussed on some of the other radio shows that if these documents are released, they may become evidence. For example, in 2011, Mitt Romney was accused of voting twice in the same election, that he voted in California and in Massachusetts at the same time. And he claimed to be living in his son's basement, an unfinished basement, as a primary residence. And if he were to release his tax statements, he would be releasing what state he is declaring his residency. But then in addition, some of the discussion late last night, I think they were discussing that Bain Capital was keeping him on the books and off the books at the same time. So where he stands as a tax dodger for his income status, according to Bain. And so I wonder if your guest has got knowledge about the legal status of his releasing these documents.
I don't know what's in the documents, and I'm not particularly sure about, you know, what the legal status is of all these issues. That's a question a lawyer can answer. But the political status is very clear that he's doing a high-risk maneuver, because by not releasing this, he simply opens up the kinds of speculation that the caller just talked about. And if there's no information there that's available for people, you can speculate all the time about everything you want. And it's really hard for Mitt Romney to refute other than saying that's not true. Ultimately, something that many Republicans are saying, if he just releases it and deals with whatever, you know, negative information is out there, he can move on when we're still in July rather than having to deal with this issue in September and October. But for some reason, he's not making that choice right now.
More phone calls momentarily. It's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network for this Monday, the 16th of July. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest, joins us fairly often. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books on various presidents and other political topics and history topics. And his latest book is Governing America. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open right now. They've been busy. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Or go to the Facebook page if you'd like. You can do that. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we are going to talk about water, particularly water in Lake Michigan. We'll look at the water levels, who gets water from Lake Michigan, how communities not too far from Lake Michigan are struggling with low water levels during this drought, how is water made available to them, and all of the other issues surrounding water. There also has been talk for years about sharing the Great Lakes with places like Arizona. Is that ever going to happen? We'll have two guests with us, Chuck Hornbach, our own reporter. He's an environmental reporter and beyond. And we'll also speak with Jenny Kale, who's director of the Center for Water Policy at the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour, and we go to Susan in Madison next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning. I have another question about helping people understand the Affordable Care Act, because I feel it's one of the most important reforms for the betterment of our society, and that it also is the basis of many of our economic difficulties. My question is, why does not Obama or some of his well-heeled supporters, such as George or others, hire a top-notch marketing firm with a history of being able to educate the populace on complicated issues that would help everybody understand the positive benefits of this act with truthful public service type sound bites, ignore the negative, to give neighbors something to talk to each other positively about, and ways to defuse the people who do not have accurate information and are defaming it?
Well, I think there's two answers, and this is a common criticism of the administration. They haven't sold this program well. They haven't really explained what it does, and so they've made themselves vulnerable. So one answer is he should do more, whether it's hiring the right public relations people or thinking through, you know, what parts of the legislation to highlight, such as, again, the very popular part that, you know, children under the age of 26 can stay on the health care plan of their parents, you know, that they should do more and that they're losing on that front. And that's why the program remains, as a whole, still unpopular, even though people like particulars in the program. A second answer is they are explaining, and it remains unpopular. And that's a more complex problem for the administration, meaning some of the concerns over things like the individual mandate drown out some of the positives, such as the pre-existing issues or the coverage for youth. And the other problem is there is great uncertainty about what's going to happen with the program, and so it's hard for the administration to totally sell something that isn't up and running. When Medicare was created and it passed in the summer of 65, it was totally up and running by the summer of 66. We're many years now out of passage of that program, and much of it isn't even running, and it's unclear how some things like the health care exchanges or the Medicaid expansion are going to work, especially with people opposing it. And so I think it's more than a matter of PR. It's partially that, but it's also some controversy over particular parts of the program and the way in which this was slowly implemented in stages and over many years has made it very hard for the administration to go on the campaign trail and simply sell it with the same kind of crispness that the opponents can attack it.
I had no idea that Medicare was up and running in a year. What a huge program to get in place in a year.
And it was Johnson insisted on it, and so did the Democrats in Congress. They understood that was really important. It was key that, you know, in a very short time this was working so that opponents like the American Medical Association would probably give in because people would see the benefits. So speed was essential to the implementation, and it was very different than how this program was structured.
Do you know why speed was not considered for this program?
Part of it was budgetary reasons, so a lot of the benefits didn't kick in until 2014, so they can use this reconciliation process in Congress, which required certain cost estimates. And if they did everything right up front, it would have cost too much, and they wouldn't have been able to use stuff that was essential to getting it passed. So that was a big part of the program, but a lot of critics within the Democratic Party were scratching their heads back then at why they were delaying so much, because you know, in politics, it's a kind of known conventional wisdom. The more you delay things, either passing bills or getting programs running, the more opportunities there are for things to go wrong and for opponents to mobilize and attack things. And that's what's happened with this program.
Mm-hmm. Lamont in Viroqua. Hi. Lamont, are you there?
Yes, get down.
Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm calling in reference to an earlier caller mentioning how there wasn't much mention or debate about the war that's happening. And my perspective on that is the reason there is no debate about the war is because both parties, or both Obama and Romney, feel very similarly about what's going on. So what's there to talk about? Which I think is very unfortunate and very dangerous and very short-sighted.
That's true. Again, I think within the party there are still critics, but they're not really going to make this a big issue within the Democratic Party because they don't want to undermine Obama's chances, and they've been generally silent. But Obama has essentially towed the Republican line, and there's not a huge difference between Mitt Romney and President Obama, at least in the campaign, on where they stand on a lot of the foreign policy issues. The foreign policy, even though it began in 2008 as the issue that distinguished Obama, has turned out very differently. You know, he's often preserved a lot of the policies of President Bush, and going into this campaign, there are not the huge gaps that you might see on certain domestic issues in terms of what the two men would do. So when you have that, it's just not a very salient issue. Maybe during one of the debates, they'll highlight their differences. But it's just hard to see this being something that's central to public discussion if the leaders aren't really talking about it.
Lamont, thanks. Josie in Sheboygan, hi.
Yes, good morning. Lest we all forget, the one comment that just sticks in my mind that Romney said when he was asked about his income and that different times during the campaign was asked, well, how much, you know, he says, yes, I do make money for speaking, but it's not very much. And then later on, it comes out that he was making $385,000 a crack or something. And also about the environment, I don't think this country, which has been the biggest polluter, and China and India are catching up for decades now, are going to do anything till something really horrendous happens. Then they're going to do something, and that may be too late. So That's my comment.
All right, Josie. Thank you.
Second comment certainly bears out in history. I mean, often we don't do things on questions like the environment until there's a true crisis. It's not a kind of rational, planned policy. We wait for the worst to happen, and then finally the country does something. And she might be correct, and that might be the ultimate solution, which might not be a solution at all. And in terms of Romney and his wealth, yes, I mean, that is the issue the Democrats want to use, to characterize him as part of the problem rather than the solution. As the new slogan says, he is the wealthy person who is preventing real economic growth for the middle class. Again, the administration has to be careful, because Republicans can turn that into an attack on markets, and many Americans who are not wealthy aspire to be wealthy. And so it's a really tricky issue for a Democrat to use without this blowing up in Obama's face.
But it's been used by other presidents.
It has been used by other presidents. But, you know, they tried that against President Bush, and it didn't work. He was reelected, and he overcame the fact he was from really one of the most privileged families in the country. And he was able to at least quash that as an election issue.
Professor Zelizer, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest this hour. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, author of many books, including most recently Governing America. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Brett Jaspers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have another hour coming up, plus the news. Stay with us.